This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. On this day in particular, we'll hear a lot about Dick Clark, and all of us can remember some of the others we lost in 2012, the famous, like Whitney Houston, Maurice Sendak, and Sally Ride, and some whose obituaries may not have made the front page, but who lived history and changed our lives. Eugene Polly, the inventor of the first wireless remote control. Judith Crist, the first female full-time film critic for a major American newspaper. Antony Dobrovolsky, the oldest known survivor of Auschwitz. Each year, we take time to focus on some of the lesser-known lives lost this past year. We've asked a few of our NPR colleagues and friends to join us. But we're going to need your help, too. Who's someone you knew or knew of whom you think we ought to remember? Give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. We're going to start with a familiar voice, NPR newscaster Paul Brown. Good to have you back on Talk of the Nation, Paul.
Always a pleasure, Neil.
And you're normally hearing Paul Brown on the morning newscast, but he's also a musician, has a band called the Mostly Mountain Boys. And, Paul, you're here to remember one of your fellow fiddlers.
Wanted to remember a gentleman by the name of Gary Harrison, Neil, who was a native of downstate Illinois. He passed away early this fall at the age of only 58, died in his sleep at home, apparently of a heart ailment. It really took all the fiddlers, I think, in the old-time and traditional and bluegrass world by considerable surprise. And Gary was one of these people, Neil, who was more than a musician. He was also a great documenter of music traditions of his home region. He became an instrument builder and was a fine tunesmith himself. He made up a lot of tunes, so he was a very inspiring person, I think, to people all around the acoustic music scene and all these different areas of it.
To give you an idea of one of the things that he collected, this is a tune Gary Harrison made with Pappy Taylor, one of the first old-time fiddlers that Gary found there in downstate Illinois. And I'm going to ask you to pronounce the name of this tune.
Sure. This is called the Butterfly Schottische. Now, the Schottische is actually a dance, and it originated, we think, in what is now the Czech Republic, believe it or not. And there was a Schottische craze, just the way, you know, there's a rock craze or a blues craze or a ragtime craze in the middle of the 19th century. And Schottische music has now infused almost every form of traditional music in the world, so the U.S. as well. And the Schottische is danced sort of like a polka. It's a little bit like a slow polka. Pappy Taylor was a very interesting man, apparently. When Gary Harrison started out as a young man looking for old musicians to record, Pappy Taylor was the first person that he ran into. And one of the great things about him was, apparently, that he was in practice, even though he was quite elderly at the time. A lot of folks give up their music, and you have to sort of urge them back into it.
Rediscovery.
Yeah, and they have to get back into practice. But Pappy was there, and he was playing at full strength when he was recorded on this day in 1979.
Again, that's Pappy Taylor, Butterfly Schottische. I hope I'm pronouncing
Schottische.
That. Schottische. Okay, there you go. We know of full-time music in North Carolina and Virginia. Southern Illinois?
Well, that's a really good question, Neil, to ask. You know, why Southern Illinois? And why are we hearing about Midwestern music here? One of the unusual and wonderful things about Gary Harrison and some of his friends who were in one of his early bands called the Indian Creek Delta Boys is that they started to collect music and to document music in areas that I would say had been undercovered by folklorists. When you think about American music, a lot of what defines it is, in fact, the cultural mergings in the South of African-American, Native American, and British Isles, and European. But there was also a lot of great music out in Illinois, Indiana, Ohio, all those states. And Gary's was one of these people who went and found it. And otherwise, it wouldn't have happened.
Well, he's, of course, as you mentioned earlier, an influential musician himself. This is a tune called Red Prairie Dawn, the title cut from Gary Harrison's album of original songs. Again, that's Red Prairie Dawn, and you could certainly see people dance into that, too.
No kidding, and you can hear that Gary had become a really excellent fiddler. You know, Neil, when I think about people we remember who may not have been just hugely famous but really contributed something, I often find myself thinking, what is it that this person contributed? And usually it comes down to some combination of personal qualities that increase understanding and expand potential and thinking and all that sort of thing. With Gary, I think about this combination that he had of empathy and openness. He could get to the old timers. He had this incredible enthusiasm for what he was doing. And then he had the ability to focus on that and pass it on. He's passed the tradition on to his daughter, Genevieve Coaster, who is playing in the last band that Gary was in. They're still out there. They're called the New Mules. And he influenced a lot of other people. So he had this remarkable combination of personal qualities in addition to the expertise. When you think back, that's what you really remember about special people when they're gone. It's those wonderful personal qualities that bring others together, and that's really what Gary Harrison did.
He also brought a musician named Paul Brown into his scene at one point.
Oh, my gosh. This was hilarious. I did not actually know Gary, and I didn't know him all that well ever. I didn't get to see him that much. But when he recorded this Red Prairie Dawn album, he had gotten a couple of recommendations from other folks that they might want to call me to contribute some of the banjo work on the album. He wrote me a letter, phoned me up, asked me if I would do it, sent me the music, and the first time I met him was when I flew out there to do this recording. It was an amazing experience. Just the way some of his friends told me that he was totally focused and would become completely expert at anything he did, I fly out there, I meet this guy for the first time ever, we go to his place, and he has purchased and learned to use a digital recording outfit to record his own album, and had become quite expert at it in record time. So it was really just an example to me of the type of person he was, incredibly focused and driven to do the things that he loved to do.
An example also of the kind of person we want to hear about today, somebody we lost in 2012 who contributed a great deal but whose life may not have been featured in an obituary above the fold on your newspaper. 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. And Paul, thanks very much for your time. We'll listen for you tomorrow morning, I guess.
Thank you, Neil.
NPR newscaster Paul Brown with us here in Studio 3A. In the meantime, let's see if we go to Steve. Steve on the line with us from Burlington in Wisconsin.
Yeah, hi. I want to remember Jonathan Frid, who was the actor that played
Barnabas
Carlins. Yes, on Dark Shadows. And he was personally important to me because I'm a fantasy, science fiction, and horror writer, and he changed my life. But more importantly than that, he changed the way that people perceive vampires to this day, because his portrayal of Barnabas made the vampire a really sympathetic character with a tortured past. He worked with the writers of the show to do that. And that's influenced everything from Langella's Dracula, which many of us like, down to Edward Cullen, which a lot of us don't like so much. But you can see his influence in the entire horror genre
and
in making the monsters human.
As I understand, he got to make a cameo appearance in the new version of Dark Shadows just a little bit before he died.
Yeah, he did. He was in there with Laura Parker and Catherine Lee Scott in the there's a great scene with Alice Cooper where they have like a big ball and rock concert at the mansion, and he's one of the guests that shows up at the door.
So were you one of those kids who were raced home from school in time to watch Dark Shadows on TV?
I was. I was one of those kids, and I was even a kid that in Boston, where I was growing up, they weren't showing it in the afternoon at first, and I would occasionally be sick in the morning when they had it on so that I could see it once I discovered it was there.
Thanks very much for the call, Steve.
All right. Have a great day.
So long. Let's see. We go next to this is Martin. Martin's with us from Denver.
Yes. Oh, thank you for taking my call. I'm a cantor in a synagogue. I have been doing funerals for 35 years, and this past week we lost a 98-year-old survivor of the Holocaust who was a very small man. He was about 5'6" tall, but really packed a punch. He smiled at everyone and loved everyone, and he was actually in synagogue only about 2 months ago to celebrate his 98th birthday.
Do you remember his name?
And Sam Fireman. Impossible to forget because he really was came to synagogue every week. And the most amazing thing was young people loved him as much as the old people. I saw him at 95 kick his heels up into the air and dance to celebrate his 95th birthday. So, and on his 95th birthday, he gave a talk in our synagogue about his story of survival. And it's a name that you would never hear, but it's an incredible soul that left the earth this past week.
And the stories of incidents as terrible as that, they lose something when they're no longer in the first person.
I have to tell you, it's been a tough year for us in that respect. I feel not only survivors, but people who lived in that time and experienced life. Even my kids, I try to get them to know what it's like to live in a world without cell phones and computers. And this guy lives in a world without, you know, cars and electricity.
We're just getting a quote of his from the Denver Post. Sam Fireman survived the Holocaust in part to honor his younger brother. Aaron Fireman died after blowing up a crematorium in a show of defiance at Auschwitz. Quote, he told me to stay alive and tell people what happened. Sam Fireman, Martin, thank you very much.
Thank you for taking us. Thank you.
If you'd like to remember somebody we ought to remember, give us a call. 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. Stay with us. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Just this past Friday, poet Jane Cortez died. Born in Arizona, she grew up in Los Angeles, lived her adult life in New York City, and traveled the world. She was active in the civil rights movement and became known for laying verses of social criticism over the tunes of her jazz band, the Fire Spitters. Here she is reading a poem called A Jazz Fan Looks Back.
I crisscrossed with Monk, wailed with Bud, counted every star with Stitt, sang Don't Blame Me with Sarah, wore a flower like Billy, screamed in the range of Dinah, and scattered How High the Moon with Ella Fitzgerald as she blew roof off the Shrine Auditorium, jazz at the Philharmonic.
Jane Cortez died Friday, December 28th. At the age of 76. Today we're remembering remarkable people like Jane who died in 2012. We want to hear from you. Who's somebody you knew or knew of who you think we ought to remember? Our phone number, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. Alan Greenblatt's a correspondent with NPR Digital News. He's based in St. Louis and joins us now from member station KWMU. Nice to have you with us today.
Thanks for having me on.
And you wanted to remember, Mark Twain scholar.
Yes, his name was Jim Cox. He died this year. He was a professor of mine at the University of Virginia, but he taught most of his career at Dartmouth. And he was just a great guy, so well remembered by thousands of students, had a really forceful personality and a great deal of humor. But I think for a broader audience, what's remarkable about him is that he's a critic who, if you read him, you not only learn about writers like Poe and Emerson and Frederick Douglass, but you learn so much about the country.
It sounds from that list, these are 18th and 19th century writers he's a specialist on.
Well, that's right. Primarily 19th century. He wrote all through American history. He wrote about Thomas Jefferson. He wrote about Hemingway. He wrote a great deal about Robert Frost. But Mark Twain is where he made his mark. He wrote a book in 1966, Mark Twain, The Fate of Humor, that really changed the way scholars look at Mark Twain and therefore the way students look at Mark Twain. What's remarkable is not just that his book is in print from 1966, although that is remarkable for such a book, but that we read so little of the critics who came before him. He really reshaped the way we think about Mark Twain, about his life and his humor and the darkness behind the humor.
You also mentioned Jefferson, this is James Cox speaking in a film by Ken Burns called Thomas Jefferson.
When you stop and think to yourself, do you really believe all men are created equal, or all people, let us say, are created equal, you have a trouble believing it, but you don't ever wish it hadn't been written. If the equality clause will trouble us 1,000 years, as Frost said, if it'll trouble us, then the pursuit of happiness will mystify us forever. And I like the trouble, and I like the mystery.
I like the trouble and I like the mystery. Good stuff.
Yeah, he was great. That little clip shows you a little bit of the music of his voice and the emphasis he would put on things. But it also was at the center of his critical vision was to find a paradox like that and to play with it and tease it and find something new to say about the author from the inherent contradictions that he presented or she presented.
And I understand he could have a profound influence on the personal lives of some of his students, including you.
Well, you know, just today I put on Facebook that I was going to be on the show, and a friend of mine who was in class with me more than 25 years ago commented about four specific memories of Cox, four little moments that illuminated Herman Melville and Poe and Jefferson, and they were very shorthand comments, but they brought him back. I mean, he's a figure who remains very clear in people's minds decades after they last saw him.
And but there's also a personal story, as I understand it.
Well, I knew him fairly well. You know, I was a student, but stayed in touch all these years afterwards. And I guess if I was to talk about him personally, I just want to remember that he died on the same farm where he was born in 1925, well down in southwestern Virginia. And he could see from his kitchen window, at least in fall, the family graveyard, which included slaves that his grandfather had owned. He always talked about how close he was to slavery and yet how far away, and he always talked about desegregation as his great achievement. But the personal story you may be referring to, I mean, I'm sounding very sober and talking about race and slavery, but he was so funny. I can't do him justice, but I once heard him give a talk on Pudd'nhead Wilson, and afterwards my girlfriend broke up with me because she realized she'd never really heard me laugh before.
I gather you always...
I don't know if that was helpful, but it happened.
But it happened. I gather he always ended his lectures the same way.
Well, for our class at least, he would always tell the students to go forth and win victories.
Go forth and win victories. Alan Greenblatt, thanks very much.
Well, thank you.
Alan Greenblatt's a correspondent with NPR Digital News. He joined us from member station KWMU in St. Louis. You can read his remembrance of English professor and Mark Twain scholar James Cox at our website. Go to npr.org and click on Talk of the Nation. Let's see if we get another caller on the line. Let's go to Daniel. Daniel with us from Maui in Hawaii.
Hi, Neil.
Hi, go ahead, please.
I just wanted to remember a musician that most people probably haven't heard of outside of Hawaii. His name was Anthony Natividad, and he specialized in the Hawaiian nose flute, which is an instrument, again, not much known outside of Polynesia. But he was a master of it, and just not just an instrumentalist and performer with Ulalena, it's a show here on Maui, but he was just a real giving guy. I mean, just full of the aloha spirit, and he would teach. He would play for people in the elder housing. He would play for kids in schools, and just a great guy all around. Anthony Natividad.
I have to confess, Natividad does not sound like a Hawaiian name.
He was born in Hawaii, but he was a Filipino heritage. And he spoke to that one time. He said how blessed he was to be, you know, here he was, this Filipino guy born in Hawaii, but he was able to perpetuate the very Hawaiian art of the Hawaiian nose flute.
And there were a fair number of Filipinos who were brought over to Hawaii to work on the plantations there.
Yes, many, many times many.
All right. Daniel, thank you.
You're very welcome.
Here's an email we have from Lavi Soloway in Los Angeles. My friend Richard Adams died in Los Angeles on Monday, December 17th. He was the plaintiff in the first federal lawsuit to demand recognition of same-sex marriage after he married Tony Sullivan in Boulder, Colorado in 1975. Adams filed a green card petition for Sullivan as his spouse and received a one-sentence denial from the L.A. District Director of the NINS. You have failed to establish that a bona fide marital relationship can exist between two, I'm going to use the word he has used in this quotation, faggots. That set off a decade-long legal battle. They lost. The couple, however, were together until the end. I was with Richard and Tony on Saturday morning, 2 days before his death, at their home in Hollywood, working with them on a challenge to DOMA, that's the Defense of Marriage Act, and an almost complete documentary film about their life and their long battle. Let's see if we go next to Sean. And Sean's on the line with us from Spokane, Washington.
Hi.
Go ahead, please.
I am calling, my wife and I are calling to remember our friend Doug, who passed away at the age of 25 this year. He actually introduced the two of us, so we would not be married without him. But more than that, we both grew up in fairly conservative Christian churches, and he changed our minds a lot about homosexuality to the point that we voted. I grew up in California. I voted for Proposition 8 in California, and just now voted to uphold gay marriage in Washington.
And died at 25?
25.
What was the cause, do you know?
We don't know. He had some health issues, but we're not certain either way.
Well, much too young. Thank you for calling to remind us of your friend.
Thank you.
Netta Ulaby reports on arts, entertainment, and cultural trends for NPR, and she joins us here in Studio 3A. Nice to have you back with us on Talk of the Nation.
Thank you so much.
And there were an awful lot of famous people in the arts who passed away this year. Whitney Houston, Etta James, Marie Sendak, Nora Ephron. Is there somebody, though, who's maybe lesser known who stood out for you?
You know, I do a lot of these, and it's really sad when it's not the big names.
I used to work the Black Border beat myself.
And, you know, it's hard to cram these extraordinary lives into sometimes just 45 seconds, and one of the people I had to do that for was Rosa G. And she was a leading author of young adult fiction, primarily in the 1970s, so late 60s and early 80s. And she's one of the people who really introduced a lot of very topical issues into young adults. She wrote about class and race and immigration and sexuality at a moment when people weren't really doing that so often in young adult fiction. And her own backstory is amazing. It's like something out of a fairy tale almost. She was born in Trinidad, came to Harlem when she was 7 years old to join her family who had preceded her there, and things completely fell apart. Her mom died when she was 9. Her dad died when she was 14. She lived in an orphanage, was shunted around the foster care system, became a garment worker when she was 14 years old, became a union organizer in that garment factory, studied acting at the American Negro Theater, which is the place that produced Sidney Poitier.
Sure, yeah.
Harry Belafonte, and then she started the Harlem Writers Guild, which was an early organizing place for people like Maya Angelou and Audre Lorde. And she wrote these unbelievably beautiful young adult novels. One of my favorites is called The Friends, which is about an educated, affluent West Indian teenager and her friendship with an African-American girl from a much more disadvantaged background.
And those who may not have grown up in the East Coast in those days may have come as a surprise. There was a lot of tension between the people from the Caribbean, the African-Americans from the Caribbean, and American blacks.
You know, and I read it as a young teenager in Kansas, and it almost doesn't matter. It does. I mean, obviously, this is what she's writing about, but these are stories that anyone can pick up and immediately get drawn into. They're unbelievably powerful, emotionally intense. Actually, when it was Alice Walker who reviewed The Friends for the New York Times, and she called it a heart slammer of a book, and it really, really is.
We tend to think of young adult fiction as, you know, that uplifting stuff, you know.
And it is. You know, I know I'm making it sound really depressing, but but her books were not. They're about human responsibility and love. And one of the sort of interesting codas of of Rose G is that one of her books for adults was based on a fairy tale, Hans Christian Andersen's Little Mermaid. It was called My Love for the Peasant Girl, and it was made into the Broadway musical Once on This Island, which got 8 Tony nominations.
Well, you mentioned that musical, Once on This Island. This is a tune from that. People may remember seeing the show, ran for quite successfully for quite some time. This song called Waiting for Life to Begin.
A stranger in white in a car going somewhere.
and that must have introduced a lot of people to that now familiar reggae beat.
Probably so. She introduced a lot of us to worlds that I'm very happy to have lived inside.
If there was one book you would recommend of hers, what would it be?
It would be The Friends from 1973, the one that I mentioned earlier about the friendship between these two girls from very different backgrounds.
Netta Ulaby, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Netta Ulaby reports on the arts, entertainment, and cultural trends for NPR. She was kind enough to join us here in Studio 3A. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
Stay with us. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And this is an email we have from Kelda. I'd like to remember my father, Marshall V. Jameson, World War II pilot, educational technology pioneer, charmer, visionary, tender-hearted father, and lover of humanity. He cared for the poor and the forgotten and the hard-working unnoticed. He was funny and passionate beyond measure. I was born when he was 61 and therefore grew up not only a child of the 1980s and 90s, but also a child of the Depression survivor on 1920s folk music and Laurel and Hardy. He died with my baby son and baby nephew in his arms after a sudden and swift bout with cancer this April to the final words of the poem, I Must Go Down to the Seas Again. And all I ask is a quiet sleep and sweet dream when the long trick's over. Thank you for listening. That from Kelda Jameson. And again, we'd like to hear from you about somebody you think we ought to remember whose life made some contribution that is of lasting importance. 800-989-8255, email talk@npr.org. And let's see if we go next to, this is Kirk, and Kirk's on the line with us from Louisville.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead, please.
Well, listen, I just wanted to remember June Curry, one of the most generous and welcoming people on earth, who passed away this past June in Afton, Virginia, at 91. For more than 35 years, she welcomed cycling tourists from around the world who traveled the Transamerica Trail on bicycle to her home, and she created what's affectionately known as the Bike House. In 1976, during the bike centennial, she welcomed the first of her many thousand, probably, of cycling tourists into her home, provided warm showers, a stocked kitchen, a nice warm place to stay, and asked nothing except a free will donation. And she was just one of the most wonderful people. She was awarded the first Trail Angel Award by the Adventure Cycling Association. And she just told wonderful stories about Afton, Virginia, this little crossroads at the intersection of Highway 6 and 250 there in Afton. And your thighs were burning by the time you got there because it's a vicious climb to get to Afton, there near Blue Ridge. And she was just so warm and welcoming and had such great stories to tell. And there are the bike house there is practically a museum. It's full of memorabilia and cards that people have sent back to her thanking her for her hospitality. I'm talking about thousands and thousands of cards and photographs, and people would leave an old bike jersey or a water bottle, inscribed with some message to her, and the place is just filled with all those things.
Was she a rider herself?
I don't think she ever was much of a cyclist or anything. It's just that when the bike centennial came through there and she saw the cyclists who inaugurated the route between Yorktown, Virginia and Astoria, Oregon, 4,600 miles, they were just on the first leg of that trip and climbed that vicious hill to and her place right there, and she offered them water and cookies, and she was known as the Cookie Lady.
The Cookie Lady.
June Curry, yeah.
Well, thanks very much for calling to remember.
My pleasure. Thank you.
So long. This is an email we have from Karen. I'd like to remember Genevieve Hughes Houghton. She was one of the original 13 Freedom Riders in 1961 on the bus with Congressman John Lewis that was mobbed and firebombed in Anniston, Alabama. A child of Southern privilege, Cornell University grad working on Wall Street, she began volunteering with the Congress of Racial Equality, organizing lunch counter deseg in New York City. Last year, she was featured in the PBS Freedom Riders documentary, Sat on the Couch with Oprah, but had never seen her show. Wonderfully eccentric, when asked by friends in her southern Illinois town why she had never told us what she had done, she replied, "It didn't matter what we'd done to change the world yesterday. only what we were doing now. She died at 80 on October 2nd. Thank you, Karen. If there's someone in life you think we ought to remember, somebody whose obituary may not have been above the fold of the newspaper, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Today we're doing the show we do each year at about this time, in which we remember the lives of people who died over the course of the year, whose obituaries may not have made the front page news, but whose lives are well worth marking. Who is someone you knew or knew of whom you think we should remember today? 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. Several of our colleagues have joined us today to contribute their stories of remarkable lives lost. We turn now to Susanna George, a producer with NPR's newscast unit years ago, a field producer with the Foreign Desk who spent time with New York Times journalist Anthony Shadid in Baghdad, Cairo, and Beirut. Though the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist's unexpected death did not pass without mention this year, we turn to her now because of the time she got to spend with him. And Susanna, nice to have you on the show.
Thank you for having me here.
And a lot of people know Anthony Shadid from his writing. You got to spend time with him.
Yes, we were sharing a bureau with him when I was in Baghdad for NPR, and I got to know him sitting around the dinner table at night. And I think a lot of us know that the curiosity and his sense of wonder from his journalism, but that was also Anthony at dinner, just having conversations, recounting the events of the day.
A lot of us hacks, as we call ourselves in those such a situation, sit around and make cynical jokes.
Yes, and that was not Anthony at all. He would even recount, you know, the frustrating process of negotiating checkpoints in Baghdad with the same kind of enthusiasm and good humor that he approached his journalism with.
I understand you got in those days a rare opportunity to take a drive through Baghdad with him, and again he didn't focus on the danger or the threat. Tell us what he told you.
Well, he narrated the entire trip in a way that turned the city that it was the middle of the summer. It was hot. It was dusty. You know, Baghdad is scarred with these blast walls along all of the main roads that make it feel very claustrophobic. But the way he talked about the city and Iraq's history and past and present, it made the city a magical place, a place that made me want to learn more about it.
A magical place for him, but not a place that he romanticized at all. He told the story through the eyes of the people who lived there, whose lives had been irretrievably changed by the events of 2003 and afterwards.
Yes.
And the kind of reporting he did at that time when we shared that bureau with the Washington Post, he was with the Washington Post and then later went to the New York Times, he got to see a different Arab world open up. I wanted to play a clip of tape from a lecture that Anthony Shadid gave at American University of Beirut. He remembers standing with a friend in Tahrir Square as President Mubarak stepped down from power.
And he gets on the phone and he says, "What? You know, he did what?" And then you just said, you looked across this crowd that went as far as the horizon, and this just kind of rippled through that crowd as Mubarak had fallen. And it was the most euphoric moment I've ever, 8 years of the tragedy of Baghdad just washed away in a moment to see this scene unfold. And I got choked up. In fact, I don't know who it was, an Egyptian came up to me and said, "Shid the halak."
Susanna, what's that little piece of Arabic there?
Well, it's an Arabic phrase that you would say to a family member at a funeral. Technically, it means, you know, hold yourself together, but it's a kinder way to say, you know, stay strong. And so I guess he was emotionally overcome at that moment.
Anthony Shadid, of course, went on from Egypt to do reporting in Libya as that country underwent its change. And, well, that was a traumatic experience.
Yes, he was kidnapped along with three of his colleagues in Libya. But, you know, when he would describe that experience of being kidnapped later, it was one of he saw humanity all around him. And when he would describe that experience, he would often tell when he the binds on his wrists that his captors had put were too tight and they were making his hands go numb. And one of his captors came over and at one point loosened the binds on his wrists. And Anthony said, always made a point to tell that part of the story and say that this is an example that the Middle East is an incredibly, it's a humane culture.
He died reporting on Syria, and it is an awful situation there to this day that, well, we miss him so much, the kind of reporting that he'd be doing.
Yeah, many times over the past year, I've thought, if only I could have his journalism to turn to. But, you know, as I was, getting ready to come here and talk to you guys today, and I was going back and looking over everything he had written, I was, you know, there's a silver lining to this, that he left behind so much that we can kind of, you know, spend time with him, even though he's not here with us, by reading his work.
Susanna Georgia with us here in Studio 3A. Yes, Anthony Shadid's obituary did make the front page of the New York Times, which he worked, and other newspapers. We bent the rules for Susanna, partly because, Anthony Shadid was a regular voice on this program as well, and partly because Susanna Georgia is an alumna of Talk of the Nation. So good to have you on the program. Thanks for dropping by.
Thank you so much.
We want to hear the stories of the people you think we ought to remember. Give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. Let's go to Lewis. Lewis with us from San Francisco.
Hello, everyone.
Hi.
I came to remember Alan Edward Forley. Alan was a radio personality here in San Francisco. He worked for KALW, which is an NPR station.
It is.
Yeah, and he worked there for about 38 years, actually. He started out in 1974 at KPFA in Berkeley, and then in 1975 he went to San Francisco and worked for KALW.
What kind of programming did he do?
He did some interesting shows. He did a thing on Noel Coward, and it was called Entourage, and it aired weekly. And he had an annual Noel Coward birthday special. He was quite connected with the Noel Coward estate and knew a lot of the Noel Coward people. He also had a show called Book Talk, and it was books that he had read and interviewed the authors. And he had a show called My Favorite Things, where he would interview people here in San Francisco, like, for example, a symphony director here. And they would play their favorite music, and Alan would interview them on the air. And he had another show called Exploration in Music, which was mostly classical-based, but he was a very interesting character. I knew him for 40 years.
What was he like?
He was a very tall, very shy man in his real personal life. But on the air, he had a big voice, and if you heard the radio voice, you couldn't compare that radio voice with the person off air. They were like two different people there.
Yeah. Well, Lewis, thank you very much for calling. I'm sorry I never listened to him.
Oh, well, I'm just so happy to put his name out there on the air.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Here's an email from Sean. Philip Baldwin, my uncle, who as a World War II pilot flew the survey flights over Japan to prepare for the atomic bomb drop and later as an attorney worked under JFK and was with him the night before he died in Texas and came up with the name for the Astrodome. Let's see if we go next to, this is Kate, and Kate's on the line with us from Santa Cruz in California.
Hello, I'm so honored to be on the radio, and I'm calling to honor Martha Benedict, and she was a pioneer in acupuncture and herbal medicine. She was an Oriental medical doctor. She was instrumental in lobbying for legalization of acupuncture in the state of California. And she helped start one of the first schools, the traditional American College of Traditional Chinese Medicine in San Francisco.
And what was she like?
She was a delight. She delighted in life until the last breath. Sorry.
I can hear you're still a little emotional, yeah.
Yeah. And she carried the healing energy, you know, with very ill people. She could inspire the healing energy in them and help heal them. And there's many miracle stories. And I met her when our children were very, very young and have known her for 35 years. And she also started a whole line of healing products of tinctures and herbs and salves that are distributed nationally under Benedictine Herbs.
Mm-hmm.
And one of her really delights, and my favorite pictures of her, is with this pipe vine swallowtail butterfly on her shoulder and flapping around her hat.
Hmm.
She became the midwives of butterflies, and the pipe vine butterfly was going extinct in this area, and so she started a project of recultivating the pipe vines that they pupate on, and it is still going to this day, and they have 1,000 little chrysalis at their house, And one of the miracle stories I love to tell is that a dear friend of hers went to a shamanic conference down in Texas and was tapped on the shoulder and taken over to a Mayan shaman from Mexico. And he says, I need to talk to you. And they translated through three languages and said, this necklace is for your friend who midwives the butterflies. And it was a beaded necklace with the image of the pipe vine swallowtail butterfly with the yellow spots on the tail. And he made this for her, and he knew that he'd meet someone who knew her.
That's a great story, Kate.
It's a great story, and it's she was a very powerful healer and a great loss to our community. And she died saying, I love you.
Thank you, Kate, for the call.
Thank you. Bye.
Here's an email we have from Paul. Florence Schultz, aged 99 years and 9 months, a remarkable lady, born in 1912. Like all those 100 years who saw the car, plane, spaceships, and all the wonders we take for granted, at age 99, a lifelong Detroit Tiger fan who attended a ball game at Comerica Park in August of 2011. We're remembering some of the lives of people who may have been, whose obituaries may not have been on the front page this past year. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's see if we can go to Carolyn. Carolyn with us from Tucson.
Good morning, Neil. It's a pleasure to be on your show. I'm calling today to remember John Fitch. John Fitch is known for several things, two of which is he was the only American to ever race for Mercedes-Benz. That's back when Mercedes-Benz was still racing in Formula One. And the other thing that more Americans might remember him for is the invention of the Fitch barrier. These are these large, usually yellow cylinders that are filled with either water or sand that are usually in front of highway overpasses. They save many, many lives for cars that go out of control. They hit the Fitch barrier and it dissipates the energy into the Fitch barrier instead of the car going straight into the highway overpass and killing the occupants of the car.
How did he get interest in the safety part of it?
It's my understanding. Well, first of all, he was in that horrible, horrible crash in the 50s. I believe it was at Monaco, where so many spectators were killed. And that was the last race that Mercedes-Benz was ever involved in with Formula One. That's one thing that got him involved in safety. The other is that it's my understanding that his son was killed running into one of these highway overpass abutments. And he thought that that in honor of his son, he would find an inexpensive way of keeping this from happening in the future.
Well, Carolyn, thank you very much for remembering him to us.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is an email that we have from Ed. The residents of the Truckee Meadows, what we call the area of Carson City, Reno, and Sparks, lost an important figure just this past week. Ed, the Waver Carlson, died last Friday. From the 70s to the mid-2000s, he walked from Carson to Reno about 30 miles and waved to everyone. Just looking at the comments on this great obit written by Guy Clifton at the Reno Gazette Journal, you can see that this simple act meant a great deal to us all. The people that personally interacted with him found him a loving and generous person. My favorite quote from the article, "The best feeling there is in the world is to feel love in our heart, then share it with the world," he said. "Thank you for doing the show. I listen each year. I love listening to the stories of people and how we all touch each other." Let's go to Brandon. Brandon with us from Iowa City.
Hi, I'd like to remember for those people in Iowa City a very special person whose name was Kevin Olish, and he was a cashier at the local grocery co-op, and he'd worked there for 16 years, and just a working-class person who was very unsung. He knew he was expert in astronomy and rock and roll and politics and could talk on and on about these things, and he had memorized, we estimated, over 2,000 member numbers. So when you went to his register, he knew your 4 to 7-digit number. So he was very unusual in this way. And he was the first one who would help people out who were handicapped. And he was the kind of person who made a difference every single day. I think it's easy to sometimes we celebrate a lot of people in the news, but the people who help us day to day are really the heroes, I believe. And Kevin Olish was really that kind of a person. And we miss him terribly in Iowa City and at the grocery store and in the community.
Thank you. Remembering somebody who's, you wouldn't think to find that obituary in the newspaper, but it's an important person as part of our lives.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Brandon.
Bye-bye.
This email from Raina. I'd like to share with you my father's story. Thanks for your consideration. A modern Renaissance man and champion of the Alaskan dream, Robert Warren Hamill, longtime resident of Girdwood and Denali Park, Alaska, died November 24th, 2012. Rob lost his life heroically assisting at a motor vehicle accident south of Girdwood while working for the State of Alaska Department of Transportation. Rob died as he lived, with sincere dedication to helping others and a commitment to humanity and justice. He was 60 years old. In 1975, Rob realized his dream of moving north to the last frontier. He packed up Harvey, his three-on-three Rambler with an extra radiator, AM radio, two extra headlights, and four extra rim tires. Rob reinforced Harvey's undercarriage with sheet metal and, with an Alaska or bust signed mounted on his trailer, set out for the Alcan Highway. Here's a couple of emails before we run out of time. We'd like to thank everybody who called, everybody who sent us an email. We're sorry we couldn't get to everybody's story, but this from Jennifer. I'd like to remember my mother, Judith Nelson, who lost her battle with Alzheimer's disease on May 28, 2012. She was a soprano specialized in the Baroque genre who made multiple recordings, including Handel's Messiah, Christopher Hogwood conducting, which BBC's Music Magazine listed at number 25 in the 50 best recordings of all time. Not only was she a wonderful singer, she was a kind, warm, and funny person who loved and was loved by many. We miss her terribly, but we're lucky to have her recordings to listen to. And this from a listener. I'm remembering my dear pal and longtime puppet partner, Terry Jean Breitbach. Terry Jean performed and did school residencies with me for 31 years. Puppet theater in all 99 counties of Iowa, plus 25 other states and four other countries. She touched the lives of thousands of children with her memorable performances and her irrepressible sense of play. Sometimes when we were working with kids in classrooms, she'd say, "Tomorrow, each of you has to bring a joke." The next day, we tell jokes as we glued and decorated our puppets. Some of the lives we lost in 2012. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington.